Just after Christmas, when the devastating tsunami struck 12 nations on the Indian Ocean, one of the first offers of help came from one of the affected countries, India. 11,000 Indian citizens lost their lives to the giant waves, and more than 500,000 families were affected. Still, India offered assistance. Such relief aid and India's refusal to accept international donations are the most visible examples of massive economic turnaround that is transforming the vast Indian subcontinent. But I gathered smaller pieces of evidence on a trip last December to India's capital, New Delhi. It was a sentimental journey, revisiting, after almost 40 years, a place I had once called home.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Delhi Airport.
The last time I heard those words, in 1966, my husband and I had come to live there. He'd been sent to India by the Agency for International Development, the U.S. Foreign Aid Agency. We spent 2.5 amazing years in New Delhi, fell in love with the people, the cultural and artistic riches of what was then one of the world's poorest nations. And when we left, we vowed we'd return someday.
This is where our life in India began.
Where we landed.
Young and excited and nervous. Every emotion you could feel.
But I remember the first time driving out of that airport, and these were just vast fields of nothing. And in the distance, little things, blobs, I thought, oh, they were monkeys or they were dogs or animals in the distance. In fact, there were people squatting in the fields at 3 a.m. when we arrived here. It's the first time in my life I ever mistook a human being for an animal. But it certainly wasn't the last year. That deep poverty is not as immediately apparent today, even though when we lived here, the population of Delhi was under 3 million, and today it's around 13 million. Now, I need to tell you right at the start that on this visit, I spent just 7 working days in Delhi, and my path while there was narrow, mostly from a good hotel to a nice neighborhood where I was doing interviews. I certainly saw slums with families jammed together in unspeakable conditions. But there are fewer slums on those same Delhi streets now, and the people who live in them look healthier.
Look at all the cars.
That is a major surprise getting back, all the cars, and all the concomitant smog, despite government-enforced emissions controls, which have helped somewhat. But the idea of pollution from cars here. I learned to drive in Delhi in the days when you couldn't find the few cars for all the bullock carts, horse-drawn buggies, cycle rickshaws, meandering sacred cows, and water buffaloes that dominated the roads. Not anymore. My friend Deepti Bhagat, for years she was a top official at the Indian Tourism Office, Deepti weaves through the dense motor traffic with aplomb and information.
Delhi has more cars than Calcutta, Bombay, and Madras combined.
Oh.
Because there's no good public transportation system, so everybody has a car or a two-wheeler.
So driving here is chaotic, to say the least. It's great fun. You feel like a Formula One driver. So you swear a little under your breath and have fun.
Deepti Bhagat, my silk sari swathed, bustling, diminutive Delhi friend, swearing? There have been changes in 37 years.
Acha, shukriya. Namaste.
Namaste.
One of the shopping areas near our old neighborhood in Delhi has not changed much. It's still a ramshackle collection of small stores offering various necessities. When we moved to Delhi in 1966, this was one of my very first stops. Now many of the little Khan Market stores have air conditioning instead of creaking electric fans, so there's more comfort when you go shop to shop.
A butcher, next to it, Ayurvedic medicine, next to that Punjab hairdresser, a chemist.
There's a fellow selling onions, another a local tobacconist has betel nuts, mild stimulants that stain teeth and tongues deep red. He also has bidis, these strong, stubby brown Indian cigarettes that can make you dizzy. But this same wala has newer addictions.
Marlboro, Marlboro Light, Benson, Dunhill.
Right here, in the middle of this dusty little market, a stack of shiny foreign cigarette packs symbolizes the economic revolution that's hit India since we lived here.
In our day, nothing was imported for sale. Back then, almost 20 years after independence, India adhered to Gandhi's principles of Swadeshi, make what you need and use what you make. Then, in 1991, after years of political and economic chaos, government reforms opened India's doors to world markets. Fueled by its dynamic high-tech industry, the country went global, and foreign cigarettes, cars, clothes, and ATMs popped up in Old Khan Market and vast brand-new shopping areas all over the capital. A massive middle class emerged with some 300 million members. That number rivals the entire population of the U.S. My friend Deepti Bhagat says Delhi's become a consumer society, and the city's young people, those with money anyway, have no concept of saving.
They want to borrow, in fact, live on plastic, and they're into the shopping malls, and they want to buy a car, a house, which is good, so long as they don't overextend themselves and, you know, land up in debt.
Still, the government claims that India boasts one of the highest savings rates in the world. But over dinner at the Indian Cultural Center, another old friend has a different take on the new consumerism. Jasbir Singh, retired now, was teaching English literature to young women at Delhi University when we lived here in the days before the economic reforms. Jasbir says deprived Indians were ready for a freer market long before the trade doors opened in 91. The country was nearing bankruptcy. Gandhi's legacy of self-reliance just wasn't working.
But such was the draw of who we were and independence and that whole scene that people went along with it. But the world was changing, and it's not easy to convince people that they should never want anything. I mean, this is what human beings do. They want things if they're available. And it's in a way very nice to see young people now enter this culture of living now by things that make your life easier today, which is something, good heavens, would have never happened. You were not ever supposed to be in debt for a single rupee if you could help it.
That's the first sound of my day. It's the first sound that I remember hearing every morning living in New Delhi. Sound of a crow sitting on a tree and looking over his prospects for the day.
That crow and we lived in a neighborhood called Defense Colony. Our address was D37. Lou Stamberg and I took a taxi to find our old house.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I wish we could peek.
A big concrete wall now conceals the modest house where we used to live. Our apartment took up the first floor. Now a shiny brass plaque announces the current tenant, a lawyer who argues before the Supreme Court of India.
I didn't remember it as brick.
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did?
Well,
I thought
I
it was white.
I saw it. It looks just like it did. It's very little changed.
May we look? Humne ritite in this house.
Maybe if my Hindi were better? Nope. The guard won't open the gate to let us in. He cracks it a bit, and we snap a few pictures. When we lived here in the 60s, we didn't own a camera, didn't want one. We're sure we'd remember everything about India for the rest of our lives. And you know what? We do, more or less, because it was so vivid, so totally unlike anything we had ever experienced before. I used to play a game when we lived in India. Wherever I was, I would turn 360 degrees to see if I could spot anything familiar. Most times, I could not. Not a TV antenna, not a smoothly paved road, not a very tall building. Much of our fascination and pleasure came from the fact that it was all so different. Today, Delhi remains different, but in new ways. Again, our friend Jasbir Singh.
The biggest change, I would say, is the size of the city. It has expanded in every direction. It has also become the city where everyone wants to be. It was very much a city for bureaucrats, for diplomats. There were universities and colleges. And then somewhere along the line, it became the place to live in. Everybody just started coming into Delhi. And suddenly, it's what every big city gives its citizens, a certain freedom to be anonymous, which Delhi never had.
Yet in the middle of the anonymity, communications have improved. lots of TV channels, and most importantly, in a country where the infrastructure is haphazard, there are cell phones everywhere. My friend Deepti Bhagat says everybody, rich or poor, has one.
And the amazing thing is that today, even a guy who comes, who's a plumber, and who comes on his bicycle, has a cell phone. You have somebody doing a petty job for you, or one who comes and delivers the mineral water, says, please call me on my cell phone. At least India's got connected.
Cell phones, TV, shiny new city buildings. But India is still a nation of villages. 70% of the country's billion-plus people live in them, often in medieval conditions. The Prime Minister's goal is to lift some 150 million Indians out of poverty in the next 6 years. So ambitious. But most Indians live now in three different centuries at the same time. Still, my ever-optimistic friend Deepti Bhagat knows her ancient country is riddled with contrasts, and she has grown used to taking the long view.
Look at this country. You have the rocket on the one hand, you know, being launched from Tumba, southernmost point in India, and you have the bullock cart. And you know, in fact, the funniest thing I heard was that when this rocket had to be carried to Tumba, they suddenly discovered it was so long and so big they couldn't carry it on anything. So they tied up three bullock carts and they carried the rocket there. I mean, unbelievable. And that is India.
That is India. And it was so good to have re-experienced it after four decades. To move again in the teacup light of a Delhi winter and be warmed by the legendary hospitality of its people. To find that for all the changes and improvements and all the stubborn problems of poverty that do not get solved, India remains rich in so many important ways. This is Weekend Edition. I'm Susan Stamberg.